where it's being pushed. But I wouldn't say there's a scientific consensus, because most scientists, even most biologists, are not engaged in this issue. It's just a small number that are doing research on various aspects of this. And when they make claims about what they might eventually do, or they make proposals about what people are demanding and so on, there are very few other scientists that get involved. The kind of culture of science is for each scientist to leave all the other scientists alone, unless they're direct competitors or colleagues or something like that. So most people are just not engaged. And that's a problem, because it allows things like this to go forward and create errors and create problems that are already there before anybody even realizes it.
That's New York Medical College Professor Stuart Newman. He spoke with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg.
Thanks for listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM in the Portland metro area, and all over the world at KBOO.FM.
Tune in to KBOO on Monday, August 7th from 7 to 8 p.m. for a live remote broadcast of Rising Up, the Power of Narrative in Pursuing Racial Justice. Journalist, author, and radio host Sonali Kolhatkar will be joined in conversation with Yvette Dion, author and executive director at Yes Magazine at Powell City of Books in Portland. The discussion will focus on racial justice perspectives in news media, entertainment, and individual discourse. Again, that's Rising Up, the Power of Narrative in Pursuing Racial Justice, on Monday, August 7th from 7 to 8 p.m., broadcasting from Powell City of Books here on KBOO Community Radio 90.7 FM. More information can be found at KBOO.FM on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hey yo, this is Clipping. You're listening to KBOO.
Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And today, leading off, we're going to summarize some of the top stories of the past week. The lead story, once again, concerns congressional hearings on flying saucers, UFOs, UAPs. And you may say to yourself, what? Once again, another congressional hearing? But you know, this time it's been different. For several reasons, it's perhaps the most revealing of all congressional hearings on these unexplained phenomena in our skies. First of all, historically, when Congress had hearings on flying saucers going way back several decades into the past, it's always been, on one hand, we had the scientists and the government officials, and on the other hand, we had farmers, school teachers, we had priests, we had ordinary people talking about strange things in the sky. And what came of those hearings? Not much, unfortunately. But this hearing was different. Different on perhaps all fronts. In fact, in some sense, it was historic. First of all, we're not talking about, on one hand, farmers and school teachers and ordinary folks saying that they saw something in the sky. Now we have the metrics. Now we have Air Force and Navy pilots revealing hours, not just snippets, but hours of tapes concerning objects that seem to, well, defy the known laws of physics. We have videotapes of objects descending 80,000 feet from the sky within a matter of seconds. Objects that can accelerate from Mach 2, that is twice the speed of sound, all the way out to Mach 20 in the blink of an eye. And not to mention the fact that these objects also go underwater. These things can go to the edge of space and also plunge into the water. And then they zigzag We have them documented zigzagging, and you can calculate using Newtonian mechanics the centrifugal forces inside this object, whatever it is. And the g-forces are several hundred times the force of gravity, which would be enough to crush the bones of any human. And so this is new. For the first time, we have metrics. We have literally hundreds of hours of videotapes that scientists are going over frame by frame, trying to figure out, well, what the hell is happening in our skies? Next, if that's not enough, then we have allegations. Allegations that the military is hiding, well, dead alien bodies. Yes, that the military is hiding conclusive evidence in the form of biologics, that is, extraterrestrial beings from, well, outer space. And not only that, we have the wreckage. We have the wreckage of these encounters. Not only that, we also have intact flying saucers. All these allegations are being made by David Grosch. And at first you may say to yourself, well, is he just a farmer, a priest, a school teacher? No, he's a Pentagon official. In fact, he's been on many of the study groups that have looked into the possibility that these objects could be extraterrestrial. And so we have now something to talk about. You know, the bottom line is journalists, after everything is said and done, say, follow the money. The bottom line for a journalist is follow the trail of money. Well, I'm a physicist. And if you're a physicist, what do? You follow the evidence. You follow the data. And now we're literally drowning in videotapes of these objects, objects that seem to be defying the known laws of aerodynamics. These objects can accelerate in the blink of an eye, leaving our fighter jets in the dust. They can go in space, go into the atmosphere, and then plunge into the oceans. Now, we can't do that. We're talking about a scale of aerodynamics that is beyond what we are capable of. And so then the next question, therefore, is what does it all mean? Well, I think the kicker to this whole thing is that the military has a split. You see, before it was a united front. On one hand, we had the farmers and school teachers and priests and what have you saying that they saw something in the sky. On the other side, we had scientists and military officials saying, huh, a bunch of nonsense. We can explain all these sightings. Now it's different. Now we seem to be having a civil war inside the Pentagon itself. And this civil war is not polite. On one hand, we have officials from the Pentagon who pretty much say that David Grosch and others are a bunch of liars, fabricating evidence. I mean, the words are fighting words, and the Pentagon is coming out swinging. The Pentagon is not being polite on these matters. The Pentagon is saying that these guys are just wrong. And if you talk to the people who are making these allegations, pilots, people with many, many hours of training, Pentagon officials, their point of view is that the military is trying to shut them up, intimidate them, because they're onto something. Well, as I mentioned, I'm a physicist. The bottom line is evidence. Where's the beef? Where's the smoking gun in all of this? And then when you go through all the allegations of dead alien bodies, wreckage from crashed flying saucers, intact flying saucers, you realize that at the present time, the critics of the Pentagon have no smoking gun. What they do have, however, is sworn testimony that they've talked to 40 individuals, many of them with top security clearance, all of whom will testify that, yes, we have the bodies. We have the smoking gun inside the Pentagon, and the Pentagon itself ain't saying nothing. And so we're at a stalemate, unfortunately. So after everything is said and done, how will historians rack this up? Well, historians of science, I think, will say that the center of gravity of the debate has shifted. It used to be that the burden of proof was on the farmers and the school teachers and the average Joe that saw these lights in the sky. The burden of proof was on to them to prove that it was extraterrestrial and not a known physical phenomenon that is terrestrial. Now the burden of proof is shifting. Shifting to the point where now the military has to prove the opposite. The military has to prove that these blinking lights or whatever they are not extraterrestrial. And so, in conclusion, there is no smoking gun. In other words, even though the critics of the Pentagon say that the Pentagon has the bodies, the Pentagon has the wreckage, people are not at liberty to divulge this information. So this information, say the critics, was given to the critics on the condition that the identities be kept secret. So in other words, we're at a stalemate. Science deals with evidence. Science deals with data. We have allegations at the highest level of the Pentagon, but we don't have the smoking gun. In other words, we have yet to find somebody out there who's willing to wave his hand and say, I got it. I have the evidence. I know where the bodies are. I know where the wreckage is. And then would lead investigators to find this evidence. That would nail it right on the spot. Or, as I say, if somebody comes up and says, I know where the bodies are, or for that matter, steal something. Steal something from the UFOs the next time you are kidnapped. That would end the debate right there. Think about it. If somebody stole something off a flying saucer, an alien ship, an alien piece of hardware, that would end the debate right then and there. We don't have that yet, but let's hope that one day we'll go to the next level. The next level beyond allegations of farmers and school teachers and priests. But let's hope that one day, whoever does have the smoking gun, whichever way the gun is pointed, will come out and say, this is the final word on this controversy. And then the other question that I get sometimes is, well, what about you, Smarty Pants? You're a physicist. What do you think about what's happening? Are these allegations credible or not? Well, first of all, there is a debate within the scientific community about these sightings. You can dismiss 95-98% of these sightings as being natural. We're talking about birds. We're talking about rain clouds. We're talking about not UFOs, but weather balloons and all sorts of different kinds of man-made and artificial things could be causing these sightings. But what about the last 2-3% of the sightings that have no terrestrial explanation whatsoever? Well, there's a split even within the scientific community about this. One part of the scientific community says that it's an optical illusion. That is, we don't have all the data, and we don't have the data in the third dimension. Now, what does that mean? If you see a balloon, and the balloon is slowly moving across your field of vision, the balloon is very close to you, and you say to yourself, well, that's normal. Balloons don't go very fast. And the balloon is rather close to you. But now let's say you don't know the distance to the balloon. If you're in a jet plane, distances are awfully hard to calculate without special instruments. So there's an alternate explanation. Perhaps that object that is floating by your field of vision is actually a rocket ship. A rocket ship very far away that's speeding right across your field of vision. Now, the two images are identical. An object in front of you, moving very slowly, has the same image as an object far away from you that is whizzing right past your field of vision. This is parallax. And so some people say that, well, that could be the cause of these sightings. These sightings are not objects traveling up to Mach 20, for example, 20 times the speed of sound. No, it appears to travel 20 times the speed of sound because it's far away. If it were closer, then you'd realize that, hey, it's a drone. It's a weather balloon. That's all it is. So what do I think? I think we need more data. I think you cannot easily dismiss the possibility that it's an optical illusion caused by parallax. Maybe, maybe not. In other words, as a scientist, my conclusion is we need more evidence. Now, there's another possibility, and the other possibility is that these are genuine, that they do represent visitations from another planet. So let's talk a little bit about the science behind that statement. First of all, when you look at the night sky, we now have a census of how many stars have planets going around them. We used to think that only a tiny fraction of the stars in the heavens had planets going around them. Nope. We now know that on average, every single star in the heavens has a planet going around it. Let me repeat that. On average, every single star you see in the heavens has a planet going around it. In other words, since there are 100 billion stars in the Milky Way galaxy, our backyard, there are at least 100 billion planets in our own backyard. This is amazing. And with the Webb Space Telescope, with better optics, we're now beginning to understand the possibility that maybe some of these planets could harbor life. We now realize that many of them have atmospheres and weather conditions totally different than what's found on the planet Earth. And therefore, you cannot easily dismiss the fact that maybe, just maybe, they have their version of DNA and RNA. In fact, we now know that on the planet Earth, meteorites from outer space, when you crack them open and analyze them, what do you find? You find amino acids. You find DNA. You find RNA. In other words, the basic ingredients of life are everywhere. We didn't know that until we started to look carefully and take a census of our own galaxy. And so, in other words, life could be for free. Every planet out there has a certain probability that there could be life forming on it. Because 100%, on average, 100% of all the stars we see at night have planets going around them. And how many of them have Earth-like planets going around them? Well, perhaps 10% of those. Who knows exactly the number? But in which case, you still have billions of planets that would have amino acids, DNA, and RNA, which are the building blocks of life as we know it. And speaking about life as we know it, let me say a few things about another thing that's been making the news recently, and that, of course, is artificial intelligence. Many people were caught off guard because we have what are called chatbots. Chatbots that are now readily available on the web, and they scan the internet, and they are, in some sense, like a glorified tape recorder. That is, they don't make up facts. They're not original. They don't create something out of nothing. What they do is they scan the internet, and they look for commonalities to what you want. If you want an essay about Shakespeare, for example, written in the vernacular of Taylor Swift, then you tell that to the chatbot. The chatbot scans the entire internet, much larger than most people's human experiences, to get quotes from Shakespeare and to write it as if it was written by Taylor Swift. And when the product comes out, people are amazed. People say, oh my God, look, this thing is real. This thing is conscious. This thing is sentient. The robots are coming. Well, Yes and no. You see, these chatbots are sophisticated. There's no doubt about that. They do represent a leap, but they are tape recorders. The bottom line is that they're not original. The bottom line is they don't know the difference between true and false. They don't know what's right or wrong. They simply cobble together different parts of the internet, splice them together, and pass it off as an essay. And people say, oh my God, it sounds like a human wrote this. It's alive. It's alive. Well, of course it sounds like a human wrote it because a human did write it. All the basic passages about Shakespeare that the machine quotes from were written by a human. So in other words, on one hand, it sounds like magic. And in some sense, it is. It's able to do things that are quite miraculous in terms of coming out with essays. But are they original? Do they represent new forms of consciousness? Higher forms of reasoning? No. They don't know the difference between right and wrong, true and false. They're very good at splicing together things that seem to fit, and you can pass it off as if a human wrote it. Now, there are two immediate impacts on this. One impact is that, well, I'm a professor. We give out term paper topics that have to be written out by the students. It means that students can plagiarize. Students can simply copy from the web. You want an essay about Shakespeare? No problem. You just talk to the computer and ask for an essay about Shakespeare in any tone you want. Let's say Elvis Presley is talking about Shakespeare. Boom, there's your essay. Now, does that mean that the essayist, that is, the chatbot, is sentient, conscious? No. That requires yet a higher level of computational ability. But they sound conscious. They sound real. They sound like a human wrote it because, of course, a human did write it. All the robot did was plagiarize. And so, on one hand, we have the fact that these things are not conscious, but they are very useful. They can revolutionize the field of journalism. In the future, if you're a journalist who does not use a chatbot of some sort, you'll probably be out of a job. Those journalists who do use a chatbot will probably thrive and have a job. So let's say something now about the job market. What does it mean when robots become more and more human-like, especially because they can scan the internet? And on the internet, of course, we have lots of human voices that could be plagiarized from. Well, there are three kinds of jobs that we can talk about. The first kind of job is jobs that are requiring semi-skills. Not repetitive jobs. Unfortunately, those jobs are going to go out the window. Jobs that are strictly repetitive don't have much of a future because, well, that's what robots can do. Robots are very good at things that are repetitive. But on the other hand, things that require pattern recognition, like eyesight, manual dexterity, like picking up different forms of garbage. Robots are very bad at that because these are non-repetitive tasks involving a fairly high level of pattern recognition. So let's take a carpenter and a hammer. The hammer does not replace the carpenter. The hammer is not sentient. It cannot talk to you. It cannot receive instructions and carry out instructions. But the carpenter needs the hammer. And so in the same way, in the future, workers will use robots. Workers will use artificially intelligent objects. But ultimately, the person pulling the strings will be a human. Robots cannot fix a broken toilet. Robots cannot pick up garbage. Robots cannot design and build a skyscraper. Robots cannot build a garden. All these things require a high level of pattern recognition. And also, these are non-repetitive tasks. Now, of course, Can workers use this capability of robots? And the answer is yes. And so the lesson here is that artificial intelligence will not necessarily replace humans, but will augment and increase the versatility and power of workers. That's the first class of jobs. Second class of jobs we're talking about is jobs that involve human interactions. For example, lawyers, teachers, jobs that require interfacing with humans, like counselors, psychiatrists. They have to understand the human mind. And robots, of course, cannot do that. Robots excel at repetitive work, but two brains are very, very different. And so here's another situation where robots can help, but cannot replace the worker who deals with human interactions at a very high level. And so those jobs are not going to go out the window. Those jobs will survive, but they will adapt. They will adapt by using robots in their work. And there's a third category of jobs, and that is jobs that require leadership, require strategy, things that robots cannot understand because robots are repetitive. You ask a robot to lead a billion-dollar telecommunication company, and the robot would go berserk. Robot that can't even operate a lemonade stand, let alone a billion-dollar corporation that has to strategize, has to understand trends in the market, has to understand what is going to be innovative and what is going to be repetitive. These are things that robots are simply not very good at. And so there's a debate within society about what to do about all these developments in artificial intelligence. Some people say ban them. But, well, that's difficult because how do you ban a technology that is easily reproduced that has benefits? Benefits because they can reduce costs and increase productivity. How can you argue against that? And so on one hand, we have the voices that would like to ban the technology or pass laws against it. And then on the other hand, you have other people who say, let 1,000 flowers bloom. Let them take over. The world will be more efficient. And if it means that some workers lose their jobs, well, so be it. That's the future. Well, those are two extreme positions. My own position is, well, in between the two. And that is, first of all, you need guardrails, but you cannot stop the march of technology. Technology is going to march forward because people want it. People want things that are more versatile, more powerful, cheaper. There's going to be a demand for this kind of technology. And you can't stop that. On the other hand, you have to make sure that it integrates well with the rest of society. That means training. You have to train people to use the technology. And the technology, as I said, is not that complicated yet, but will become more complicated in the future. The point is to train people to use this technology in the same way that carpenters understand how to use a hammer, in the same way that architects understand blueprints, in the same way that teachers understand the inner workings and the career paths of their students. We have to make sure there's an integration on one hand between the technology and on the other hand the demands of the workers. So I think there is a middle ground. We don't want to ban the technology totally. There have to be some guardrails because every technology has a downside. Every technology we have to make sure is in the interests of society as a whole without diluting the march of progress. And so I think my position is in the center. That is, don't fight the technology, understand it, guide it so it doesn't hurt people, and use it to make society more efficient, to increase productivity, to increase the general welfare of the population. So That's my position on the direction of artificial intelligence. To Exploration with Dr. Michio Kaku. In the second half of Exploration, we're going to talk about the possibility of, well, will the Webb Space Telescope find evidence of life in the universe? As we said before, one dot in the night sky can be magnified by the Webb Space Telescope to give you a photograph of trillions of galaxies. And then the question is, with so many galaxies out there, what is the probability that a few of them have life on them? In other words, maybe some of them have rocky planetary surfaces with oceans, maybe an atmosphere with oxygen and water vapor, and perhaps the beginnings of life. And if microbial life gets off the ground, eventually will evolution create sentient beings like us? Well, to probe these questions, we're going to bring on an astrobiologist, Dr. Robert Hagen, author of the book Genesis. So we're going to talk about the possibility of life in outer space using all the tools of modern physics and chemistry and biology. So once again, today in Exploration, we're going to talk about life in the universe, the Webb Telescope universe. The first question for you is, how did you first get interested in science as a youth?
Oh, man, I was so excited about nature when I was young. We had a house in Cleveland, Ohio that backed onto a swamp. And my brother and I would go tramping back, and we'd collect butterflies, and we'd collect frogs, and we'd collect crayfish. And at night, I loved looking up at the sky and the stars. And so my parents bought me a telescope, and the first one was really small, but then I got larger and larger telescopes and ended up building my own. So I loved looking at the sky, and Saturn was my favorite. So nature just turned me on. When I was in high school, I moved to northern New Jersey, and northern New Jersey is just a gold mine for minerals. They're famous mineral localities, and I had a teacher who pointed me in the direction, said, go to Franklin, New Jersey, go to Paterson, New Jersey, collecting minerals. And that's what really got me into mineralogy, which is my main field right through college.
Okay, now you are an expert in an area that is not familiar to the average person, and that is something called astrobiology. So what is astrobiology?
Oh, astrobiology is one of the most amazing new integrated fields in science. It's the study of the origin of life, the distribution of life in the universe, and also discusses what the future of life might be in the universe. This is a field that has been brought to life by major new funding through NASA and the NASA Astrobiology Institute, which is based at the Ames Research Center in California.
Okay, so your book is entitled Genesis, The Scientific Quest for Life's Origin. Let's begin now in the year 1953 with an experiment done by a graduate student under the direction of his advisor by the name of Stanley Miller. Could you tell us a little bit about that experiment and how that led to a paradigm shift with regards to how we view Genesis?
Boy, Professor, what a transformation that was. Stanley Miller, young 23-year-old graduate student at the University of Chicago. His mentor was Harold Urey, who had won the Nobel Prize for the discovery of deuterium, the heavy hydrogen isotope of heavy water. So Urey was incredibly famous. Miller was unknown. Miller came to Urey and said, I want to try an experiment to make the molecules of life from nothing more than a primitive atmosphere. Now, Urey had proposed the primitive atmosphere consisted of hydrogen, methane, which is the natural gas you burn on your stove, and ammonia, that's the strong-smelling chemical from ammonia cleaners. And he mixed those together with water and just ran electric sparks through a piece of glassware. And lo and behold, in just 2 or 3 days, that clear, colorless solution began turning shades of pink and then brown, and then black gunk started getting deposited on the sides of the glassware. Miller had made a whole range of organic molecules that were basic building blocks of life. The amino acids that make our proteins, the sugars that make our carbohydrates, all sorts of molecules that form cell membranes called lipids. And not only that, a few of the bases that are called, these are the molecules that are key components of DNA and RNA. Many of the most fundamental building blocks of life just appeared out of a simple primitive atmosphere and sparks like lightning.
Okay, so let's back up a bit. What we're talking about is getting a flask with horrible chemicals like ammonia, methane, hydrogen, sending a spark through it, essentially replicating what they thought was the early atmosphere of the Earth bombarded by X-rays and lightning bolts and so on and so forth. And bingo, out of that came the building blocks of proteins, amino acids. So what was the reaction of the scientific community, which before that experiment was really basically had no theory as to how organic chemicals could form out of nothing?
It's true. This was a bombshell. The scientific community looked at this and said, wow, this must be how life originated. If in just a couple of days you can go from a simple atmosphere to all these building blocks of life, then given millions of years, the early ocean would just have been chock-a-block full of all kinds of organic molecules. And that was what led to this idea of the primordial soup, an early broth of just the right building blocks for life. So people thought, gee, it's just going to be a matter of 10 or 20 years and we'll know everything there is to know about the origin of life. Of course, that was a little overly optimistic. It's taken us a lot longer and we're still a long way from knowing. But this was the first experiment, the seminal experiment that set us on the path to believing that there is a chemical origin of life going from the simplicity of a geochemical world to the complexity of the biochemical world.
Okay, so back in the 50s, they thought that the early atmosphere of the Earth was a hostile brew of ammonia, methane, hydrogen, and things like that. However, today, we're not so sure.
That's right.
Today, many groups have proposed a different scenario for the formation of life on the Earth, very similar, of course, to what Miller and Urey had, but with a different chemical composition of the soup. What is now the leading theory as to what the atmosphere and the oceans look like back then?
Well, the one thing about the atmosphere is that Urey's idea of an atmosphere with hydrogen and methane is much to what's called reducing. We think that it was a much more chemically neutral atmosphere, including things like nitrogen, the dinitrogen gas that makes up most of our atmosphere today, perhaps some CO2, perhaps other minor components like carbon monoxide, maybe a little bit of methane, maybe some hydrogen, but not as chemically reactive as the atmosphere that Miller proposed. Nevertheless, when you put sparks through any of those atmospheres, you still get very interesting products. So the basic concept of the Miller-Urey experiment is certainly valid. But there are other environments, as you suggest.
Okay. Now, the Alvin submarine, which was used to probe the Titanic riding on the bottom of the ocean, and also to retrieve a hydrogen bomb dropped off the coast of Palomar, Spain, back in the 1950s, was also used to investigate what are called volcano vents. And some people say that perhaps volcano vents is where life got started. It's one theory, but could you elaborate on that theory?
Yeah, the idea here is that life requires a couple of simple ingredients. It requires water, some kind of water-rich environment. It requires energy of some kind. Now, Miller said lightning, other people say sunlight, but you also have the energy from the Earth's inner heat, and you require carbon and other carbon-based compounds, what are called organic molecules. Turns out one of the most exciting environments on Earth where all three of those ingredients come together are the deep ocean vents, the hydrothermal vents, or the black smokers, as they're sometimes called, on the bottom of the ocean. And these were discovered in the late 1970s by scientists diving in the submersible Alvin off the Pacific coast. Completely unexpected to find not just these hydrothermal vents, these undersea smokers, if you will, with all sorts of mineral-rich hot fluids coming out, but to find living communities far, far below the influence of the sun, where it's totally dark all the time, and yet life thrives because of all that energy coming out of the ocean floor.
Now, when we talk about energy, we realize that we mammals get our energy by eating plants. So we mammals could not have been the first form of life on the Earth. But plants, in turn, get their energy from sunlight in a very complicated process called photosynthesis, which also could not have been the original energy-generating device because it's very complicated. And we're talking about creating life from nothing, almost. So you're saying, essentially, that the energy supply could have been this very caustic environment on the bottom of the ocean?
That's the theory, and here's why people think that might be so. In our bodies, the energy, for example, from plants or from sunlight, is converted through a process called oxidation-reduction reactions. These are reactions just like that occur in a battery, your flashlight batteries. You're basically transferring electrons from one group of chemicals to another. And that exact same process occurs deep on the ocean floor because very, what are called reducing fluids come out from the below the ocean surface and they hit very oxidizing water in the ocean. And that couple, the oxidation and the reduction together, causes chemical reactions. Just like in a battery, just like in your body, that's what we think the very first energy for life was, just like a battery driven by the Earth.
Okay, now the astronomer Fred Hoyle had a different theory. In fact, he was quite the contrarian within cosmological circles. And he said the following, that the Earth is 4.5 billion years old, roughly speaking. And during the first billion years was the age of asteroids and meteors, constant bombardment by debris from outer space for about 1 billion years. We see that on the moon even today. And as a consequence, if life formed in the oceans would have boiled off. And therefore, life could not have gotten started within the first 1 billion years. So after the age of meteors ends, boom, bingo, life gets started very soon. So he says this means that life could not have started on the Earth. It came from outer space in the form of spores. So he called this the panspermia theory. But what are your thoughts about the panspermia theory?
Well, at first glance, it sounds like a pretty crackpot idea, you know, life being seeded from outer space. But a lot of scientists are now taking this very seriously. I think there are two possibilities. One is that life is a cosmic imperative. It arises everywhere, and it arises very quickly. I've heard scientists say life comes about in 1 million years or 1,000 years. There's one very famous scientist in the field who even says it takes 2 weeks. Well, if that's true, then life would have arisen on Earth and there's no problem. But what if life does take hundreds of millions of years? We have a planetary neighbor, Mars, that was habitable long before Earth, much less in the way of bombardment by meteorites, much more benign in terms of its temperature early on. And it had oceans or lakes. We now know that from these recent discoveries by NASA. So Mars was habitable hundreds of millions of years before Earth. It's very possible that life arose on Mars, and then there's this amazing mechanism. If Mars gets hit by a modest-sized asteroid, say something that's 10 or 20 or 30 kilometers across, there will be, it's been shown, there'll be rocks thrown up into space, and those rocks will be relatively unheated, relatively unstressed. They could contain microbes. And those microbes could then be brought to Earth by Mars meteorites. So there are a whole group of scientists that are giving very serious consideration to the idea that all life on Earth is Mars life because Mars was habitable earlier. And we may know that if in the next decade or two when we go to Mars and we look specifically for life, we may find Earth-like life or fossils of Earth-like life on Mars that represent our ancestors.
So if you want to see a Martian, you should simply look in a mirror.
That's possible.
Now, let me ask you a question that's bothered me for a long time, and that is the Earth is roughly 4.5 billion years old, but there's only one DNA molecule, rearranged in different ways, of course, but there's only one DNA. It has ATCG as the building blocks, the nucleic acids. That's why we can eat anything on the Earth. We can eat sea urchins, we can eat insects, we can eat plants, even though we're separated by a tremendous evolutionary distance, because we're all made out of the same molecule. Now, if the Earth is 4.5 billion years old and life gets started pretty quickly, then how come it didn't start again with another DNA? And again, and again, why don't we see different DNAs? We only see ATCG. We only see a certain set of amino acids, and that's it. We've had now not just a few hundred million years, but we've had 3.5 billion years of quiet oceans with no meteor impacts to speak of. So why don't we have many DNAs?
Boy, Professor, you know, that's such a great question. And a lot of us are asking the question in this way. Is the chemistry that we see in life today inevitable? Or are there lots of alternative pathways? Well, if there are alternative pathways, why don't we see them? And the explanation that's most often given is that life was a competition. And once that first successful self-replicating cell with all of its proteins and DNA, that very efficient, very powerful mechanism, once that cell got started, then it divided in a flash. You know, microbes can divide in less than an hour. So you had one, then two, then four, then eight. And in a matter of weeks, the whole Earth was populated by that extremely successful self-replicating cell. And that cell ate everything else. You didn't have a chance. If you weren't the first on the block to know how to live and know how to reproduce, then you were going to get eaten because you were food.
Well, let me ask you a question then. Food depends on proteins. Proteins, in turn, depend upon a template, that is DNA template, to create the protein. But there are many proteins that nature has not used. There are many proteins that you can create that nature has not even thought of. So why didn't another DNA get off the ground that was uneatable, inedible, that it was based on proteins that simply cannot be digested by our DNA? And it's not based on ATCG, the four nucleic acids, but it's based on a different set, you know, PQRST or whatever. And it creates proteins that are undigestible by our cells, and therefore the two life forms should coexist. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think partly that life has been very careful in the molecules it selects. For example, RNA uses ribose. DNA uses deoxyribose. Why those particular sugars? These are sugars with five carbon atoms, and there are dozens of different sugars with five carbon atoms. Why those? Well, it turns out there's actually an advantage to those molecules because of their particular shape, and people have shown that if you try to use other molecules, they don't work. So to a certain extent, the molecules that life uses are the best molecules for the job. But also, I think life is incredibly good at taking various other potential molecules and eating them. It's just amazing how life has used all different kinds. Anything in this environment that has energy, life has learned to eat. And I think it's just once you get one kind of life established, it's really hard to get a second competitive system going. It's sort of like the ultimate monopoly. You can imagine some company makes the best car, the best computer, and other companies try to get started, but if that first company is so huge and so large, it just swallows up the competition and nothing else to get going. Sort of like the diamond monopoly of De Beers. You know, there's never been another big company making diamonds because De Beers buys them all up and swallows up the competition.
Well, the reason I ask you this is because in science fiction movies, we always see aliens from outer space that want some very specific things. First of all, they want to eat us, meaning that they can digest our proteins, which I find remarkable. Second of all, they're going to want to mate with us, in which case they have basically the same DNA as us, literally, so they can interchange DNA sequences with us. And I find this rather impossible. But what you're saying is that in some sense, DNA really is preferable. And that maybe when aliens from outer space land on the Earth, they're going to have DNA which is very similar to ours. Is that what you're saying?
I think it's possible that some aspects of biochemistry will be very, very similar, maybe even DNA and RNA. But I think there will be very important differences. For one thing, we have what's called the genetic code. And that basically are sets of three genetic letters that match up to different amino acids, the building blocks of protein. I think that code may be wildly different there is a code on other worlds, that it would be very different from ours. So I can't imagine there being that kind of unity. So there's some chance events, some chance chemical events in the origin of life. But I think there are also some aspects of origins that are going to be very similar from world to world.
Okay, well, if you say that, if another DNA got off the ground and our DNA basically ate up that DNA, then what happens when alien DNA reaches the Earth? Will our DNA consume molecule for molecule their DNA, or vice versa? Perhaps their DNA will consume ours.
Well, that's a real good question. It depends on the building block molecules. I can imagine alien DNA, I can imagine alien proteins that are totally poisonous to us, and vice versa. It's also very possible that life on other worlds started with an opposite-handedness. There is a very curious characteristic of life on Earth that all of the sugar molecules used in DNA and RNA are called right-handed. All the amino acids used in proteins are what are called left-handed. So there are mirror image molecules that our bodies can't use. In fact, that's one of, for dieting. There's a new product out. You can buy left-handed sugars, which taste sweet, but the body can't digest them. So this is one kind of artificial sweetener, which gives you no calories. It's a great invention. It's a great idea. So if there were an alien life form that happened to be reversed, and they used left-handed sugars and right-handed amino acids, then they couldn't eat us, we couldn't eat them. I think we'd probably get along.
Okay. Now let's get back to the Miller experiment, because there's a huge gap that we left unfilled. Miller showed that amino acids, in some sense, are for free. We see them in nebulas in outer space. We see them in the cores of meteors from outer space. Amino acids are out there in outer space. However, DNA is extremely complicated. If you look at a DNA molecule, you say to yourself, oh my God, look at that thing. And it would have taken an awful long time for Miller to get a DNA molecule off the ground. If he had done his experiment for maybe a billion years in that little test tube, then maybe he would have gotten one DNA molecule off the ground. So there's missing steps now. So some people say that before DNA, there was RNA. And before RNA, there was even more primitive structures even before RNA. So what do we know about the gap between the amino acids that are for free that we see in the Miller experiment, and RNA and DNA?
This is probably the single biggest uncertainty in question, but there's so many great ideas out there. For one thing, as you say, RNA is a very complicated molecule. It's hard to imagine how it was synthesized from scratch in a prebiotic soup. Mineral surfaces may have helped. There are some minerals that attract ribose. There are some minerals that attract the bases. But there are other neat ideas out there. In the book, Genesis, I describe an experiment by a person at our laboratory, a guy named Nick Platz, who realized that you could build up an RNA-like molecule from very, very simple building blocks, little cyclical molecules, the kinds of things that are produced when diesel exhaust burns or when you have a sooty fire. That soot itself, if you put it in water under just the right circumstances, will form tiny little stacks of molecules. And those stacks, if they're in just the right environment, will attract the bases, the four letters A, T, C, and G of DNA. And those bases can line up on top of each other, and you can actually make a RNA-like molecule from scratch on the primitive Earth. Now, it's very possible, I think, that this is the sort of intermediate step where you build something that's simple from simple building blocks, and that mimics what's going to become more and more complex. You add layers of complexity gradual, one step at a time. So Nick Platz's idea is very, very powerful, and it's now being studied experimentally. That's the kind of thing people look for. You go from simplicity to complexity through a process known as emergence.
Now, if you go back, way back into the past, and what do we know about the most primitive DNA or RNA on the Earth?
Oh, Professor, that's a wonderful question, because it has to do with what are essentially the most primitive biochemical features. What are the chemical fossils that we find in modern life that point to the earliest life? And I think the conclusion is unambiguous. There are a few chemical pathways that are buried in every single living thing. One of those is RNA. The ability for RNA not only to store information and pass it on from one generation to the next, but also for RNA to improve or catalyze certain reactions. Another is a cycle of what is known as metabolism, that is taking energy and atoms from the surrounding and building up new molecules. There's something called the citric acid cycle that seems to be built into every living thing. And there are a few other chemical pathways, the ability to take nitrogen and convert it to ammonia, for example. That's also fundamental. That's a way of using the element nitrogen in biological systems. So there are a few chemical pathways that we find in every living thing, and those we believe are the most primitive chemical pathways that point us to something about the earliest life.
And where are these organisms that are the most ancient, most primitive forms of life on the Earth? Are they in the bottom of the ocean?
Right now, the most primitive organisms that we know of are all in very extreme environments, in places where the acidity is very high, in places where it's very cold, in hot, deep hydrothermal vents. And people have two ideas about that. One is a possible, very real possibility that life originated in one of these extreme environments. The other possibility is that life originated near the surface, like Stanley Miller would say, but because of those nasty asteroids and meteors and comets that kept blasting the surface, the only life that survived those last insults was life that had adapted to the deep, hot, protected environments within the Earth's crust. So either way, those are the most primitive organisms that we see today.
And that concludes our interview with Dr. Robert Hagen, astrobiologist and author of the book Genesis. This interview was pre-recorded. Let me say a few things about Drake's equation, which we alluded to. Frank Drake was an astronomer, and back in the 1950s, he tried to estimate how many intelligent life forms there could be in the Milky Way galaxy. Now, back in the 1950s, there were huge unknowns about our galaxy, and we've been able to fill in some of the dots. For example, how many stars are there in the Milky Way galaxy, our backyard? About 100 billion stars. Now, how many of these stars have planets going around them on average? This was something that was totally unknown back in the 1950s, and now we have a census of the Milky Way galaxy. We find that on the average, every star you see at night, on average, has a planet going around it. So, how many planets are there in the Milky Way galaxy? Roughly 100 billion planets. Now, of these 100 billion planets going around stars in the Milky Way galaxy, how many of them have Earth-like planets? Well, that's a number that we don't know, but we can estimate it at perhaps maybe 10% of the previous number. And so we're still talking about not 100, but 10 billion Earth-like planets in the Milky Way galaxy. And of them, how many of them have atmospheres and perhaps even oceans? That's an unknown. And if they have oceans, do they have microbial life? Do they have DNA and RNA and amino acids? Well, we've been able to find asteroids, meteors that contain amino acids, RNA, and DNA. And so we know that the ingredients of life are much more common than we were originally led to believe. But we still don't know how many planets that can support life there are in the Milky Way galaxy. And then of these planets that have liquid oceans and, let's say, oxygen atmospheres, how many of them have intelligent life? And that, of course, is a huge question mark. For example, on the planet Earth, our sun is about 4.5 billion years old. And in that period of time, we have basically one intelligent species that got off the ground after 4.5 billion years. And that is Homo sapiens and you and me. So these are still huge question marks in Drake's equations. But when you do the equations and you make rough ballpark estimates, you still come up with the fact that there could be millions of Earth-like planets in the Milky Way galaxy harboring intelligent life. And now, let's go to the killer question. Of these intelligent life forms, how many of them have mastered interstellar travel? That could be a dividing line. Because rockets that, let's say, take off from the Earth, chemical rockets that reach the nearest star, Alpha Centauri, would take about 70,000 years. 70,000 years for a conventional liquid fuel rocket to reach just the nearby stars. Forget the distant stars. In order to have warp drive, you would have to have a civilization vastly more advanced than anything that we've seen. It may take us millions of years before we reach the point called the Planck energy. The Planck energy is the energy at which space and time become unstable. Take a look at the most powerful machine we have on the planet Earth, the Large Hadron Collider. How many times more do we have to augment that machine before we can reach the Planck energy? And that is a quadrillion times. So in other words, that could be one of the dividing lines between a civilization that has warp drive and a civilization that does not. But since the galaxy is billions of years old, and you do the equation, and you assume an exponential increase in power over the decades, over the centuries, over the millennia, you can still find the fact that perhaps within 100,000 to perhaps within a million years, an advanced civilization will attain the Planck energy, 10 to the 19 billion electron volts, and with that, perhaps, the ability to create a warp engine.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2H2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring a full-time development director. This position leads all fundraising campaigns in alignment with KBOO's mission, goals, and policies. The development director works closely with management and staff to identify funding priorities and create major donor campaigns, capital campaigns, and grant writing. More info can be found at kboo.fm/hiring. We will begin reviewing applications on August 7th, and the position will remain open until filled. KBOO is an equal opportunity employer.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! You're listening to KBOO 90.